Hello, and welcome again to Comic Connoisseurs. Tonight we'll be talking about The Defenders, the latest Netflix series of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You, of course, know my co-host, JT from Saskatoon.
I'm the champion of the 8th City of Heaven.
Also with us is Red Ink.
Sweet Christmas.
And let's talk about Defenders, also known as...
Defenders.
You can tell whose scene it is by which lens... filter they're using.
The greatest non-team in the history of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yes. And by the way, I didn't notice this the first time I watched it, but I did the second. You can literally tell whose scene it is before the character walks in by the color of the lens filter they're using. It's Jessica Jones's scenes are colored blue. Luke Cage's are colored yellow. Danny Rand's are colored green, and Matt Murdock's are colored red. If you watch this the series again, you'll notice that every scene, until they're all together, are colored by those colors. And it's very distracting.
It's very distracting because it's one of the rules in filmography that you're not supposed to change your filter. If you choose to use a filter, which usually sets a mood, like, say, Gladiator, where they use the globe filter through the whole movie.
Yep.
If you choose to set a mood, you're supposed to stay with it. You're not supposed to change it.
Absolutely. And like I said, if you watch it, you will notice it. You'll notice it, and it's like blaring loudly to me. Overall, I didn't have a lot of problems with it at first until we got to the end of the first episode. And, see, I would like to believe that Marvel and its cinematic universe has got to where they are now based on the fact that they avoided the petty politics in the movies, at least. In the comics, they're fucking screwed. Let's be that clear. But in the movies, I thought they got this far by like being broad enough with their morality that they never really like offended any demographic, you know? But there is a scene where you can tell that they went, oh, fuck it, let's just go social justice warrior on this shit now, too. So part of it is the hand is starting some nefarious drilling into the Dragon Graveyard. Spoilers, by the way. There's going to be a shit ton of spoilers, and I don't care. So this drilling causes a tremor in New York, like a 4.1 earthquake. And as always, in a crowded metropolitan populace, once there's an earthquake and like power goes down, what's the next thing that happens? Looting. And so there's a scene where Matt Murdock is crouched on the roof, listening in. And he decides he's going to respond to an emergency. What is the emergency? A bunch of teenagers are robbing a pawn shop blind. They are running out, not with like things that... Like, you could even make an argument, oh, they might need, like batteries or flashlights. No, they're stealing, like, flat-screen TVs and shit. And so the owners of the pawn shop, the people who are protecting their business, have shotguns. And they're like, drop that shit right now. And the robbers, they are running away. They are not dropping it. They are not stopping. They are not surrendering. They are still stealing from these owners. So Matt Murdock shows up, and what does he do? He beats up the store owners.
Yeah, I know the scene you're talking about, Ben, but the guys, like, I don't think they were still carrying a TV.
They were still carrying a TV. I watched the scene over again to make sure that there was no, they didn't make it morally gray of, oh, they're surrendering and they're going to shoot them anyways. I'd watched again to make sure about it.
Because I remember watching that, and it was, like, they said something about, like, take it easy, man. The guy was still ready to...
Yeah, take it easy, you know, but we're still stealing from you.
I'm not still stealing. I mean, like, fine. Like, I don't remember that at all, Ben, that they were... Like, I swear it was just him... Like, one of the guys said, take it easy, man. Like, look, we're not... We'll leave it.
But and they then... didn't leave it. They were still running with it in their arms. Those are just words. You can say words, but actions speak louder than words, JT.
I'm just watching it right now because...
I know, I heard them say we'll leave it, but then the next scene shows them still running off with it.
Okay, fine. You don't think there's a little overreactive that you chase him out in the alley? Like, he's not going to be a good guy. And I mean, we got to move along. Like, he's not coming out. He's going away for killing somebody. It's not even going to be a defense of private property if he chases them down into the alley. Like,
in Texas, it would be.
Well, it's not Texas now, is it, then?
In most of the states, it would be. I mean, honestly, we're talking. Let's look at it this way. Let's say someone is stealing your car. And do you go, oh, well, whoops. And you have a gun, and you are able to hit them, like, 50 yards away. But let's say that you're 50, they're less than 50 yards away, but they pulled off of your driveway and now on the street. Do you go, well, you know what? Whoops. I could stop them right now, but I'm not going to. Hold on a second. I'm still not done with my example. This is just like the argument that about the Walmart 50 yards rule.
Walmart has a 50 yards rule?
Yeah, if you get 50 yards away from the store, they're not allowed to try to stop you.
Okay, we're getting wildly off point here, Ben.
The point remains is one of the principal foundational ideas of America is you have the right to protect your life and property. And what's the second part of that? And property. We're talking about a store owner, someone who probably has a family, who has kids, who depends on him running a successful pawn shop. And here are a bunch of people coming out, bringing out $5,000, maybe even $6,000 worth of his merchandise out of his store that he could have been able to sell. And now he can't because they were able to run away fast enough from him. So according to you, if they get it far enough away, you know what, he's supposed to go, oh, well.
First of all, that's not the point I was trying to make. I just thought they didn't actually have the TV in their hands. And also, we are so wildly off base here now.
I have a problem with this scene, and I'm not gonna just act like the scene didn't happen. Okay, JT?
Well, you don't have to, Ben. It's just we're supposed to be discussing this scene, and you're hung up on the fact that this guy exercised his constitutional rights,
and Daredevil beat him up. Yeah, I am
a guy. The man with the enhanced senses that can tell when you're lying by listening to your heartbeat could tell from a distance that this guy wasn't just trying to defend himself. He was preparing to pull the trigger and murder somebody. So he did what he thought was right, which is kind of the basis of being a vigilante, doing what you think is the right thing.
So was the store owner, though?
He's not defending the robbers. He stopped somebody from killing somebody, plain and simple. That's what Daredevil does. He saves lives.
Let me tell you a story about the LA riots.
Oh, Ben, this has nothing to do with the Defenders.
I'm sorry, but look, we'll move on after this. I promise.
Oh, I hope so.
In the LA riots, there was a lot of footage of lots of stores being broken into, lots of business being robbed blind. But there's one really compelling piece of footage. There is a small convenience store. And on top of the convenience store is a tiny little Korean man with an AR-15. And his store was not, it was the only store in that block that was not robbed.
Okay.
And that is my point. So let's, Red, do you have any thoughts on this one particular scene or not?
Wait. How is that even the point, Ben?
The point is that sometimes the threat of violence is not enough of a deterrent. Violence itself has to be the deterrent.
Okay, so how does this go back to Daredevil being in the wrong for beating the guy up when he was about to kill somebody with a shotgun?
He's about to stop a criminal with a shotgun. Whether or not he killed him depends on how he shot him with the shotgun. You're implying an end result to an event that didn't even happen yet. Which, by the way, is a legal murky area that Matt Murdock Daredevil should be familiar with. If anything, he should be acting within the confines of the law, and help making sure that the pawn shop owner.
Stop. We're going in circles here. For one thing, if Daredevil had to walk in the confines of the law, he wouldn't be a vigilante.
That's true.
Because that's illegal as fuck. The other thing is he was doing. JT is right. He was doing the right thing, doing what he thought was right. He wasn't necessarily doing the right thing.
Okay,
just let's put a pause in this. Maybe we should just start from the top and...
No, we're fine with this. Let's keep going.
Okay, we should give a quick basic rundown of the plot of the series.
Okay, that's fine.
Which I can do, if you wouldn't mind. I can sum it up pretty quickly.
All right, JT, go for it.
Okay. All right. So The Defenders takes place at least 6 to 8 months after the end of the last Netflix Marvel series, which was Luke Cage. We see Daredevil going stone cold sober. Matt Murdock is not out dressing up as the Devil of Hell's Kitchen. Jessica Jones is still trying to deny being a hero after the events of her series. Luke is just getting out of prison, and Iron Fist is still searching for the Hand and trying to figure out what their plot is. Their plot somehow involves the giant hole that we saw in Daredevil Season 2, which eventually is revealed to be ground zero for a front company for the Hand in the city. We see Stick come back to, you know, clue everyone in as to what's going on, why the Iron Fist is so important. And we see the origin of the baddest mama in the Marvel Universe, that is Miss Detective Misty Knight. Now, we'll get more into details there, folks, but that's the basic overview of what's going on. I will say one thing. Yeah, the heroes aren't all in the best of places when this series starts. I mean, Daredevil is, he's doing pro bono lawyer work because he's still living off that nest egg that his dad set up when his dad was murdered all those years ago, which is kind of how he could afford that sweet loft apartment. And they have, like, honestly, some of the best acting in that first episode of Defenders, where Matt gets, like, an $11 million payout from this chemical company for this kid who, you don't even look, did they specifically mention what he had, or it's just some after effect of something in some building materials?
I think it was just some sort of unknown after effect. And I do have to say, I did like the speech Matt gave to the kid. Basically, he says, you know, it's not really going to get any better. It's your choice of what happens after this. Mm-hmm. And I think that was really one of the best character moments of this series, because again, I think that that's what defines Matt Murdock Daredevil is, you know, the ability to look and say, yeah, it doesn't get better. It just gets different.
Yeah. And what did you think of that moment in the first episode, Red?
I think it was a pretty good speech.
Especially since, I mean, it's coming from, like, Matt went through much the same thing all those years ago when he was first blinded. Like,
what I like is they didn't have to say that. I mean, again, I think that the speech, the actions spoke louder than the words in that, you know, because he didn't have to say, look at me, or I went through the same thing. He didn't have to say that. I think that shows the confidence of a good, confident writer was behind that scene.
Well, yeah, but I'm just saying it's because Matt would have gone through, like, all the faux platitudes and fake concern that, not that people weren't concerned, it's just, I had much, like, years ago when I worked at 7-Eleven, I got beat pretty bad one night at work, and I can kind of relate to something like that where people go, oh, yeah, I'm so sorry to hear about, you know, you just after a while, you just get sick of that, and, you know, you wonder how you're going to carry on. So, and then I love the scene where, I think it's like second episode, where Foggy, I love Karen shows up and, you know, Karen goes to lunch with Matt. And then in the second episode, he meets up with Foggy. And honestly, I love Foggy in the season 1 and 2 of Daredevil, but in this one, him and Karen kind of come off as kind of pricks.
Like, I think the biggest thing there is, again, they see being Daredevil as a drug to Matt Murdock. They see it as him being like a struggling alcoholic. They see it as okay, yeah, he's done some good, but he has to stop. And the biggest problem I have with that is this is not a world where Daredevil is the only superhero. And in a world like that, you can make that argument. Where this is a world, again, where you have the Avengers, you have the Spider-Man, you have everything happening here, and where superheroes are becoming more and more common, and Matt's not exactly in over his head here. He can handle it if they let him, or if they help him handle it. But it's like they see it as enabling to help him. And again, if he was the only superhero, I could almost see it. I could almost see the argument for it, but he isn't, so I don't see it.
Yeah. Well, what did you think of Foggy and Karen, Red?
As somebody who has dealt with others who have had addictions, I'd say it was a pretty good portrayal of somebody who is dealing with an alcohol, somebody who's quit, somebody who doesn't want their friend to go fall off the wagon again. So I don't really think of them as assholes. I think of them as concerned. But sometimes, like, as a superhero fan, you want the superhero to get out there. You want them to kick ass. You know they can do some good. But if you're that friend, if you're a friend of a superhero who's actually going out and hurting himself, and he's blind for one thing, and he's out going out and fighting crime at night and coming back with cuts and bruises and scrapes every freaking night, wouldn't you be concerned about your friend?
Well,
wouldn't
yeah.
You, like, dude, you gotta calm this shit down.
Yeah, it's not so much that I'm against them being concerned for Matt, and Ben's right, it's like an addiction, obviously. It's just, I didn't get that, it didn't feel like they cared. Like, Karen did, but Deborah Ann Wall's performance, I don't fault. It's just, Fulton Reed there, Foggy Nelson, it didn't come off like he was trying to be a friend or he was trying to help Matt. You know, it didn't feel like he was concerned at all. It just felt like he was really annoyed, and the only reason he was doing this is, you know, like, hey, knock that shit off. I can't deal with your bullshit.
That's what happens. That's something that happens when you deal with a drug addict or a fucking alcoholic, because you get to the point where you're just so jaded, like, fuck, keep doing it. Keep drinking. I can't give him $50 without him going out to get drunk. He won't pay his goddamn power bill. Shit like that.
Okay,
that's where Foggy was at that moment. He just had enough.
I never...
To the point where he did the exact same thing with other people in that situation. And as he gave Matt... He got frustrated, and he gave Matt his costume. Like, fuck it, I don't care. I can't keep doing this. I care about you, but I have my limits, kind of idea.
Yeah, no, okay, I get that. See, that's the one thing that kind of bothered me in the last couple episodes, where Foggy shows up. It's like, here, like, did you really think... Okay, so we're going with the whole supposition that Matt as Daredevil is an addiction, because, you know, they haven't quite got it that, you know, he is Daredevil. Daredevil is he. Like, this is just who he is, and this is his life. Did Foggy really think giving him the costume was a good idea? Like, now again, I've never dealt with somebody with any sort of an addiction like that, but to me, just handing an alcoholic another bottle of beer just doesn't seem like the proper solution.
It's not. It never is.
Talking
about an addict or an alcoholic, talking about you're watching your friend in pain all the time. Even though they're trying to quit, they're in pain. And you want to ease that pain. And you feel sorry for them. That's kind of what I saw in Foggy. Like, to me, I know you didn't see it, but to me, it was a great performance.
Well, okay, and again, you see, the one thing that, like I said, the reason that doesn't work for me, like, where he gave him the costume there in the second to last episode, was in the final episode when him and Karen are having that tete-a-tete in the church. You know, how we can't say anything because, you know, they're going to put it together, you know, that Daredevil was Matt Murdock. And, it sounded like he was surprised that Matt went running out with Jessica and Luke, and he escaped from the police station. It's like, did you actually expect him to do something different? I mean, yes, he did, but he's honestly surprised that Matt did that. I mean,
well, the biggest thing you got to keep in mind is this, and this is not a case for every alcoholic or even most alcoholics, but I have seen some alcoholics actually keep a bottle of something just in their house, and they would just occasionally just look at it and then put it away.
Okay.
It's not exactly healthy actions, but sometimes just knowing it's there is enough to know that they don't need it. Did that make sense? I think that's what Foggy was trying to do, was basically say, okay, here's a costume, now you can actually make the choice. And honestly, I think we are sort of pinpointing one of the issues that the Defenders has, is it's very Matt Murdock centric. At least the good 40% of it focuses on him, while the rest of it is split amongst the other characters. I think honestly, if you look at the characters that are involved here, Jessica Jones had the smallest sliver.
I'm not.
Well, she was more integral in.
Hmm?
Go ahead, Red. You were saying something before.
I started babbling.
I'm not complaining.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, Jessica was part of it, but she was her backstory, because we got the two seasons of Daredevil, so I guess in the writer's mind, they're given more development to Matt and everything. But Jessica does perform, I think, a pretty important function in the series, in that, you know, she comes up with some vital pieces of information. And I think she's more of a like an audience surrogate than, you know, Daredevil or Power Man or Iron Fist, in that, you know, she has the most natural reaction of anybody, is like, she just doesn't want to get involved. You know, she just wants to stay the hell away from this, you know, crawl back into a bottle or, you know, get back to work and all that. You know, so it's not perfect, but it's there.
True. But if you look at the other characters, I mean, if you look at, you know, Matt Murdock is the guy that may not admit it until the end, but he's itching for a fight again. You know, Luke Cage is the one who wants to defend the neighborhoods. Danny Rand is on a mission to kill the Hand. And Jessica Jones is just, like you said, just wants out.
Yeah.
And the one thing I have to say, though, that I'm also disappointed in is this hallway fight was easily the weakest of the hallway fights.
And it wasn't in episode 4. Tradition says it's in episode 4.
I don't really care that much about which episode it is, but again, this was a very weak hallway fight. We could have seen something that was really dynamic, that really had all the characters comboing with each other, and we don't get any of that. We have something where they're fighting, not even that many enemies. I mean, you don't have that sense, like the Daredevil hallway fight had a sense of bleak desperation. The Luke Cage one had a sense of like undogged, like you can't stop this fucking wrecking machine. But you don't get anything like that in this one.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, you talk about combos. I mean, they did have that one sweet sequence that, you know, it was spoiled in the trailer, where, you know, everyone gets a good shot, and then, you know, Iron Fist has that quick little jump spin punch that, you know, when he lands like that. I gotta say, Iron Fist in this series, Finn Jones' performance as Danny Rand, a.k.a. the Immortal Iron Fist, and I love Michael Colter's, Luke Cage's reaction. He's like, I'm the Immortal Iron Fist. You're who? Like, yes, that's the sort of reaction I want, but Finn Jones' performance in here is, I think it's far better than what he had in the entirety of the Iron Fist series, because this is kind of what Iron Fist should have been in that first season, was, you know, he has purpose, he has intention, you know, he's kind of high in his own, he's high in his own supply as far as his, you know, purpose is, and everyone just kind of looks at him like he's batshit insane, because he's talking about, you know, growing up in the city and having fought a dragon. Like, that's how he should have been in the first season. I mean, I still kind of enjoyed it, bits and pieces, but it was way too much this kid who's clearly got the world's worst case of PTSD. I mean, losing his parents in a very Bruce Wayne-ish style, and then being abused by Kung Fu monks for like 15 years, you know, that's going to warp a kid. And, you know, he comes up surprisingly well adjusted for everything that he's been through. But I do like how, you know, he didn't grow a lot. I think, again, out of all the characters, he, like in his own series, he had the least amount of character development. But for however little he did actually have, it's still, he had some. And I like how he kind of grows up by the end of the series.
The one thing I don't like is the fact that they had to connect the Hand to Kunlong. And the fact that it felt very lazy to me. It felt like very, Asian's Asian. And that's almost insulting. That's almost, like... Again, very lazy. I mean, you don't have to have the Chase, the Hand, and Kunlun connected. The fact that they aren't connected implies a bigger universe and things that aren't, you know, that don't have to be linked to be a part of a bigger whole. I mean,
yeah.
And again, I feel like again, the lazy. It's lazy. I like the idea of the five fingers of the Hand. Sigourney Weaver, fantastic actress. and her Alexandra character is a bit of a paper tiger. You never get a real sense that she's dangerous other than the fact that she makes lots of vague threats and she makes references to the fact that she's lived forever. And the problem with that is the second, the instant that you know, Black Sky Electra, you know, attacks the Japanese member of the Hand and knocks him back, I knew that whatever hold Alexandra had on her was gone. And basically, I knew that it was just a matter of when Electra turns on them. So, again, not surprised that it happened, and I think that that's sort of, like, the most hilarious thing was, here's someone we're supposed to think is, like, this master conniving person who was able to withstand multiple secession attacks and usurping and mutinies and et cetera, and she can't even tell that this trained weapon, the Black Sky, is no longer in her control. I was like, again, she's a paper tiger, and I feel like it all fell apart, and they didn't know where they were going, so like, okay, Elektra's the villain now.
Yeah, I know, I just, you and I have been babbling back and forth for way too long. What do you think of Iron Fist Red?
Iron Fist was the weakest performance
in
the series, in my opinion.
All right, but do you think it's, like, do you agree with me in that it was better than the series, or just, like, what did you like, not you. Like?
I agree with you. He was better in the series. He was more like Danny Rand was in the is supposed to be in the comics, but that speaks for the Iron Fist series. Like, the Iron Fist series, as we know, was weak and shitty.
It was weak sauce. Agreed. I think the biggest thing was what I wanted to see more of was things like, you know, the scene of them having dinner together. The fact that, or the scene where Danny Rand and Luke Cage are talking at the dojo, having a conversation. I think in a series with where you have like all these superheroes together, fighting an army of immortal ninjas, the most interesting scenes were the ones where they just sat down and talk. I think that that's really telling.
Yeah, I like the kind of point counterpoint between Iron Fist and Power Man. Like, you have that first very, it's not exactly an SJW sort of situation, it's just,
it kind of was,
in that first conversation they have in Colleen's dojo, where, you know, Mike is like, I know what privilege looks like.
That was look, I hate the fact that those words were used and those words were picked. We're talking about someone who, when he was a child, lost his parents, and there's a great quote with that. No amount of money in the world can make that better, and then he, again, like y'all pointed out, was abused by monks for the next 15 years of his life, and you want to talk about you know. Privilege and majority, you know, we're talking about a white boy that gets stranded in an Asian country on top of a mountain in Tibet somewhere, where he's the only white guy surrounded by Asians. And now all of a sudden, you know, he was privileged his whole life? When the amount of time where he had the money and he had the ability to use it amounted to, like, 5, maybe 6 months out of, like, what, 25 years of his life? Privilege?
That.
Privilege?
Well, I wouldn't know.
Again, it's like, you know, it is a piece of dialogue created in ignorance of the characters, and again, it's very politically motivated, and I didn't like it. But I'll let you two continue for a moment. Just keep going.
Okay. So one thing I want to ask you, Red, when we first, we know the Hand's been involved in, they're kind of like the anti-Shield, you know, stringing everything together from Daredevil Season 1 to the Defenders. What did you think the end game was going to be with them buying that land and digging the hole? Like, we know what the end result is, that there's apparently a dragon's graveyard for, like, the deceased members of the Sholau is the dragon in Kunlun, I believe. That's how it's pronounced, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we know, we find out that in the hundreds of feet underneath Midland Circle, which is this front company that the Hand builds to disguise their digging for this dragon graveyard, you know, and it just happened to be on underneath New York City on the island of Manhattan. Okay, Marvel Universe, wacky mystic things happen. I got that. Now, what I want to ask you, knowing what's happening there, what did you think was going to be the end game? What did you think the Hand was up to?
I certainly didn't think it was going to be a dragon graveyard so they can get immortality barbecue sauce.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's lazy writing, that the Hand is supposed to be like Hydra. They're supposed to be like AIM, like this next level evil organization. And they're we're going to take over the world. Like, maybe I've read way too much Daredevil, because I was like looking at how Sigourney Weaver was dressed with some clothes that, you know, had like snake skin looking designs on them, or just how she stood always wrapped up in that. I thought she was going to be part of Snake Root, which was like this sect within the Hand that's responsible for resurrecting people. And they were part of the Fall from Grace storyline in the 90s, where Daredevil was wearing his armored costume. And it's kind of lazy. I say it's lazy because in the respect that there's that, I don't know if it's an urban myth or not, urban legend about how, you know, you taking like ground up rhino horn for fertility and all that. Like, that's kind of what I got, is like you're cutting up essentially steaks, like slabs of the dragon bones. You're grinding them up and what are you guys, snorting this? You're ingesting it, shooting it up. This is how you maintain your immortality, by like snorting the ashes of a deceased immortal being, you know, because so we know the Hand.
It doesn't make sense.
Well, no. See, what I thought was, and this is something that's taken from the Iron Fist and Wolverine miniseries in the mid-90s, which ran at the same time as the Heroes Reborn comic book that came out like post-Onslaught, prior to Heroes Return, where Danny Rands, because of shenanigans in him losing his chi and regaining his chi, the life force of Kun Lun was tied to his heart, his own heartbeat. And eventually when he dies, wherever he is, Kun Lun will manifest in the real world again. So I thought they were digging like some mine shaft for Kun Lun. They were trying to finagle some way that Kun Lun's going to be reborn in New York City and it's going to overtake the city. I thought it was going to be something much more comic booky like that. You go, Red.
When I first saw it, and we're talking about the Defenders. We're not talking about Daredevil or anything. My thought then. We're talking about when I watched the Defenders. I first thought that it was going to be a gate into Kun Lun, and I was confused. Like, didn't you guys kill everybody in Kun Lun?
Yeah.
Then they dropped the fact that it was Elektra who killed everybody in Kun Lun. And maybe these guys aren't allowed past the gate. Maybe this was a gate to get them in to come.
And they even talk about like how they have that wall with like, it looks like Arabic style writing or runes. So I didn't get quite a good look at it when they take Danny down into the sub basement of Solitude. And yeah, I thought it was going to be like some portal back into Kun Lun. No, like you said, Ben, it's, I do kind of agree tangentially or tacitly, I forget what the word is. I do kind of agree with you. It is lazy writing to have the Hand, they're exiles from Kun Lun. But that's something that's been done like number of times over the years in Iron Fist stories, so I'm kind of cool with that.
The problem I have with it is not only that it's a connection that was never there before, it also makes the implication of Asian is Asian, and it that itself is lazy. And
welcome to being Native American and being put in TV.
How is it Asian is Asian? Like, Kun Lun's always been a native thing. Like, there's been the arguments, like, in the current... Well, there's two current Iron Fist series, but in the one that's...
Let me explain why... Because, like... like, the idea of, let's say, a ninja. A ninja is a purely Japanese idea. The guy wearing the pajamas with throwing stars and
Chinese ninjas. I've seen them in comics.
But the specific ninja is a Japanese. There are Chinese equivalents to ninjas, just like there's European equivalents to ninjas. But if you say ninja, you think a Japanese guy in pajamas. And so the hand was, if you look at the Daredevil seasons 1 and 2, the hand is comprised of primarily Japanese people. The people in their highest ranks in season 1 and 2 of Daredevil are Japanese, not Chinese. They're all Japanese, and so, Okay, the hand, a ninja organization, is Japanese, and now it's like, no, the hand is 5 people from all around the world that left Kunlun millennia ago, and they just happen to use Japanese stuff most of the time, and that to me feels like, again, it's just like the Chaste. Why can't the Chaste be a thing that doesn't have to be from Kunlun? Why does the Chaste have to be a part of Kunlun? Why does Stick have to be a servant of Kunlun? Why can't the Stick just and the Chaste be something separate? The problem with having everything tied together is it makes the universe smaller, not bigger.
Okay, but one thing, Ben, the Chaste has always kind of been part of the hand, not of Kunlun.
I know, but that's what I'm saying is the problem is the series made it part of Kunlun. The Chaste has always been an enemy of the hand. I agree with you. That's a fact. But again, by making everything connected, you make the universe smaller. Like, a great example of this is, and I can't believe I'm quoting this comic here, but this comic has a great example of it. Red, you remember the manga History Strongest Disciple Kenichi?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's this character, this side character, whose name I forget, but he had like long shaggy hair. And he goes out and up into the mountains to train, and like he makes a lot of noise, and this old ancient master shows up wearing a bear skin. And this ancient master's like, "You have disturbed my sleep, but because you look interested in martial arts, I shall teach you one move." And in this series, you have lots of martial artists and martial arts masters who know of each other and know about each other. But when these masters hear this story, they're like, "Oh, holy shit, we don't know who this guy is." And all of a sudden you get a sense, oh, this universe is just a little bit bigger now.
Mm-hmm.
And again, by having everybody connected, you make the universe smaller, not bigger. And the Marvel Cinematic Universe, if anything, needs to feel bigger, not smaller.
Well, but you're talking about that as a whole. Now, we're talking about the Defenders. These guys are street-level heroes. They are taking care of, for lack of a better term, street-level problems. Like this, obviously, there is the argument, why aren't the Avengers involved? But then, you know, we got to deal with the Sokovia Accords, which is something I'm surprised they never brought up in Luke Cage at all. Like, I'm surprised, like, somebody
he's
from, like, the
caution.
UN...
He's essentially a citizen, you know, doing like, neighborhood watch stuff. I mean, technically,
well, there's two reasons why it's never been brought up that I can think of, logically. One, he went to jail, so his powers would be registered.
Okay.
And two is that the Netflix are tied into the Marvel Universe, but they're technically not a part of it. In other words, none of the Defenders are going to show up in the big, massive crossover movie.
Well, there's rumors they might, but we'll see what happens come Infinity War. Now, the other thing I was going to get at, like, no, I agree with you. It's lazy in some respects to connect the hand to Kunlun. And you're right, by connecting like that, it doesn't make it bigger. It makes it smaller. The problem being, Ben, is not, comic book fans aren't the only guys watching this. And narratively speaking, it's easier, and I don't mean that in any negative or positive way, it's simply easier to get the make the villain's plan, you know, a little more focused or part of the story. I'm struggling to find the right words, but it makes it easier to understand why the Iron Fist is involved, why the Iron Fist is, you know, the destroyer of the hand, why he is responsible for taking care of their evil. Now, there's connecting villains to the heroes in a way that is extremely lazy, like 89 Batman with the Joker being the guy that killed Bruce Wayne's parents. Now, I agree that's very lazy, but I kind of like it. But having the hand be exiles from Kunlun, fine. Well, I can go with that. I mean, we're talking about a universe where aliens with technology so advanced it's indistinguishable from magic, where a scientist gets peeved because the barista doesn't get his coffee order right, and he's going to turn into a 9-foot-tall behemoth with excessive anger management issues. If we're going to start complaining about incongruities like that, then how are we able to enjoy anything that this cinematic universe provides us?
So what you're saying is suspension of disbelief should still hold true.
Exactly.
The biggest problem I have with this is, again, that, you know, like I've said before, and I think we've gone through the show before, is the 20-minute rule. Again, the 20-minute rule doesn't really mean 20 actual minutes, but in the first, let's say, 10% of a movie, the first 10-15% of the movie, or 10-15% of anything, you can have your audience buy anything. Because basically they are the most open to new concepts. They are the most accepting of connections and plot elements and etc. That is when you can explain things the best, or even introduce things about the world without losing them. The problem I have is most of these revelations were done at or well beyond the halfway point of this.
Well, yeah, I'm not saying it's perfect. I'm just saying we're talking about a universe where a kid gets toxic goo splashed in his face and he turns into a blind, superpowered ninja. I mean,
this is true.
We've already drank the Kool-Aid. We shouldn't be trying to, you know, puke it up by this point. But I'm going to ask you guys this. Who's your favorite villain in this piece?
Probably Madame Gao. She's the only one that really seemed threatening. I mean, Elektra gets confused the second Matt Murdock shows up in the fight. The rest, like swarmy guy, like cams it up, but doesn't really seem that threatening, other than against Colleen Wing and no one else. The Japanese guy like talks about, oh, I killed a bear with my bare hands, but he doesn't really do shit. Black guy gets captured off screen.
And I totally thought that was going to be a turn. Like, they captured Luke and mind whammied him into being an inside man. I thought for sure they were going to do that.
And this brings up something else. I mean, Danny is a bit of an idiot because basically, not only do the other defenders figure out what's going on, they're right. They are right. The Iron Fist is the key to all this. We need to keep him off the battle lines and keep him away. And then Danny's like, no, I'm too important. Only I can kick their ass. And they're like, dude, have you seen the rest of us? We kick plenty of ass. Yeah. And he's like, no, it has to be me. I'm the Iron Fist. I'm the most important in this of us all. And again, it's like, we don't really get a sense that the other people are wrong, because they aren't wrong. You get a sense that Danny is just so self-important and so up in his own hype that he can't see the forest for the trees.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to throw it over to you, Red. Who is your favorite villain in this piece?
I'd have to say Madame Gao.
Yeah.
Like, if I wrote this, I would make the handle originally what they were, and that's just people who are in charge of the criminal underground. And I would make it so that it was Madame Gao who was actually kicked out of Kunlun, not everybody else.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. See, when Madame Gao first showed up in Iron Fist, first of all, the actress, Wai Ching-ho, she owns every moment on the screen, even when she kind of becomes a subservient little rhymes with witch to Alexandra in this series. Like, that's the one thing I didn't like, is how all of a sudden she's like, oh, okay, I'll do what you want. Whereas before, she's just this... She played smug villainy just right, in my opinion. Like, she's sitting there, she knows a lot more than she's giving, but she's not going to give you anything. It's just, I love that. I originally thought, like, having seen her in, like, season one, and I forget, did she show up at all in season two of Daredevil?
Yeah.
Yeah. Just when you first see her, drug lab in season one, and they've got the symbol of the steel serpent. Now, it's basically the Kunlun dragon symbol, like what the the scar from Shaolou on Danny's chest. It's that without the wings, but that's the symbol of the steel serpent from the comics. And in my mind, I started putting a headcanon together, and I thought she was going to turn out to be Crane Mother, and oh my god, they're going to do this the Immortal Cities of Heaven story arc from the Immortal Iron Fist comic, and oh, this is going to get so good. And then she's a member of the Hand and just sort of evil.
Yeah. Exactly. You know? And again, it's like, I do like some of the setup. I mean, the fact that you have this scene where you have, quote, the girls... You know, every girl that's not Jessica Jones, you know, setting up the charges, fighting the lamest of the Hand members, Suave Guy, as they call him, and
Bakudo.
Yeah, and there is actually something happened that I was like, I knew they were going to do in this. I knew they were going to cut off Misty Knight's arm. And I knew they were going to set up a friendship between her and Colleen Wing, which, by the way, is just started it with this. And I know that if we ever see them again, she's going to have a goddamn robot arm. And I don't know if they're actually going to go full Heroes for Hire sort of with this, but...
I'm kind of hoping for a Netflix original movie, Daughters of the Dragon sort of thing. That's Ramon Rodriguez, who... I wish I could not remember the first time I saw him, and unfortunately I do. He was Spike's roommate in Transformers Revenge of the Fallen. I know Shia's name is actually Sam, but he was Spike. Let's be serious about that. I didn't mind his character. It's just... He was playing Suave without having any personality.
Exactly.
You know, and... I liked his performance, but that's, you know, on a scale of 1 to 5, it's like a level 1 or level 2. Like, there's nothing particularly endearing, or he doesn't have like some sort of like raw magnetic charisma. You think of guys speaking these lines, which just he would have something that would just make us like, yeah, maybe he's got a point. You know, just it didn't play. Now
he came off almost like a date rapist.
I what do you think, Red? Do you think he came off as a date rapist?
I think he came off as... Who's that guy who used to be on TV and would, like, cold read people?
That John something, yeah, that...
John Stewart?
No.
No, was
John
crossing,
Edwards.
That's it, yeah, crossing over with John Edwards.
Sunshine,
yeah.
Go away today.
He came off as a corny dude who was pretending to be philosophical and shit, like John Edwards. I don't think that was their intention. That's the thing that bugged me.
But the way he
I think
was,
they
he
wanted
was...
him to be, they wanted him to be philosophical and deep and all that shit, but he came off as a guy just pretending to be.
I agree. And I think, like I said, I get the date rapist thing just from the way you talk to Colleen Wing. It's like, he's acting like he date raped her before and he wants her back.
I think date rape's a little strong, but he comes off... I do like, when I think about this, this makes more sense in my head, maybe it'll make sense in yours, is the betrayal that Colleen obviously is still dealing with, because, you know, she was raised by the Hand, she believed in this mission, and then it's kind of, her whole world is turned upside down. He comes off as, like, this really smug cult leader that, you know, he is so in love with his plan, I don't know if he necessarily believes, but he's so self-assured of this plan will succeed that, you know, he literally cannot conceive of anything else happening.
Just like John Edwards.
Yeah, but John Edwards doesn't have as much charisma as Ramon Rodriguez does. And then again, it doesn't really come off in the performance. It's like Murakami was the Japanese badass that, you know, killed a bear. And
he does, everything he does badass is off screen. He never does anything badass on screen. It's like, oh, I killed me a bear when I was only 3, off screen.
Yeah, I'm just saying it's I liked his performance. Like, yeah, you don't get a lot of evidence of his badassery.
He dove into shark infested waters for a bottle of wine, and fought off evil sharks for the bottle of wine just to uptell Alexandra and show her off screen.
All right. So.
I mean, that's the hardest thing I have with him is the fact that every feat he has, you have to, like, put afterwards, parentheses, off screen.
Well, yeah, and it's, again, suspension of disbelief. I'm going to ask you, Red, what member of the Hand did you like the most, and which one did you like the least?
Like I said, Madame Gao I liked the most. Mm-hmm. The one I liked the least was Electra.
Yeah. Like, how many times was she going to walk up and stare at the size and then walk away, walk up, stare at the size, walk away? It's like, just fucking grab those things and stab somebody already, woman.
And then she
you
did.
Know you want to.
And then she well, did.
Yeah, but she...
And again, it's like, the one thing is, okay, she's facing off a room full of four immortal, you know, long-lived fighters that know lots of mystical mumbo-jumbo.
Finger yeah, quotes she, immortal, because if you're going to be snorting brown dragon bones.
She shanked the bitch from behind, but they're facing her forward, and they're all of a sudden going to just take her orders because, hey, that sounds like a good idea. Let's listen to the person who just shanked her leader.
Well, I'm fairly certain...
barbecue sauce.
Yeah.
Can't smother herself with that sweet, sweet sauce.
Sorry, I got to say this. Baby back ribs, barbecue and, sauce.
But, let's talk about the ending, because I think we sort of, because again, you know, I think Night Nurse, great performance once again, actress, Rosario Dawson, great actress. Most of the supporting cast, excellent work as always. I mean, everyone from, everyone that's the supporting cast, I can't think of one other than, like, the hand that, like, fell flat, you know, with Date Rapist and Off-Screen Man. But again...
One thing, Ben... Sorry, I'm just saying one thing before we get to the end. I realize this is exactly how police would work, but in the short time, like, they keep referring to the incident, like aliens invade. Like, can no one say the day aliens invaded? The police are still acting like this is the real world, like that they can control crime. Like, you've got aliens, you've got superpowered armored titans of industry, you've got all this, like, you don't know whether that guy that owns that old desolate warehouse at the end of the street is just storing old conveyor belt parts in there, or if he's got a supervillain lab and he's working on some horrible new weapon. But the idea that Misty is, like, she brings Luke back into this life of being a quote-unquote, you know, hero, vigilante, be doing the right thing, and then she gets pissed at him when he actually does that. And then she keeps telling, no, just you tell us what you know, the police will deal with it. The police in the Marvel Universe are about three steps removed from being the police in the Adam West Gotham City. Just about useless.
And
they're so useless to the point that Captain America has to instruct them to create a barricade.
Yes. And he tells them where to cut it off, where to create a barricade line in the city, and how to evacuate the sections already attacked. I mean, you also have the scene where you have like this police captain like talking to Misty Knight saying, "Oh, you overreached. I'm going to enjoy seeing you get removed from your job," and he's like acting like such a cunt, and he was, and it's like. But the problem with that is when you have a character acting like that, and then what happens? Nothing. There's no payoff for that, either good or bad payoff for that. It's just he acts like a cunt for like 20 minutes in the last couple episodes, and then no payoff. Good.
They should have had I'll talk about this once we get into like the aftermath of the finale. But I mean, it's essentially a 2-part season finale. Like they figure out that okay, whatever's going on, it's at Midland Circle, like the evil front company of the Hand. They get there, like Danny's been kidnapped by Elektra. After the not unsurprising quote-unquote heel turn of Stick, who's come back, you see him held captive in like the first or second episode, he slices off his own hand to escape, which that's a badass point.
He should have left him with the middle finger sticking out.
Yeah, but then they would have been ripping off their own work with Deadpool, but still would have been an awesome shot. Yeah, and it seems like as much of an asshole as Stick is, and believe me, Scott Glenn is playing this man perfectly, I'm still rather surprised by his heel turn when he's about to, you know, separate Danny's chi from his body, and then he's killed by Elektra. Elektra kidnaps Danny, takes him underneath the Midland Circle, kind of does the whole, we're not all that different, really. I was abused, you were abused, you know, let's go kill some cops, it'll be fun. And then she basically goads Danny until he lights up the Iron Fist and punches a wall. And in that moment, I flash back to Super Bitch Prime punching the Crystal Cave wall in Infinite Crisis. And it's not a portal to Kunlun, like we are all probably thinking. No, it's they locked the door, we didn't have a key, and now we're welcome to the Dragon Graveyard.
And the biggest problem is, technically, you know, the very few people who love Danny Rand would be upset, but technically Stick was right. If he killed the Immortal Iron Fist, the hand would have lost then and there. They would have had no way to open that door, and they would have been like, oh, well, bugger this.
Yeah.
So they were out of, barbecue sauce to resurrect Danny Rand, so they couldn't do that because they used the last of it for the marinade for Elektra. And I think
is anyone else just getting hungry right now talking about how the hand brings people back?
With a kimchi marinade, yes.
Yeah. So, what?
That's racist.
Do you think they could have put a little more planning into blowing up the building red?
Maybe a bit more, yeah.
Because we should mention, folks, the part of the Jessica Jones subplot in the first couple episodes, because none of the heroes actually meet until like the end of the second episode. There's this guy who was his wife, the architect, which it just sounds like he's supposed to be really important. No, he's just an architect. Is this guy that kind of abandoned his wife and child. The wife comes to Jessica to find him. He turns out that he was killed and resurrected by the hand, and he was the guy that developed all these buildings, all these cities, which are all essentially hand front companies. And big surprise there. And then his big plan is once he figures that they're evil and he wants no part of it, he's going to blow up the building. Okay, fine. It's going to cut them off from what they're digging for. He's going to destroy the building by taking out the support columns. Seriously, you need to be an architect to figure that part out?
The problem I have with the architect subplot was implied that he knows something that important because he shoots himself in the head just so Elektra wouldn't get his knowledge. And it's like he already had the maps and the blueprints of the building and the C4, so he already marked where he was going to blow it up, so there's nothing he knew that they needed to know. That they couldn't get from the evidence locker. The biggest problem I have with this is I thought they were implying that there was something feng shui going on with how these buildings were built. Something like, for example, this was, and I hate to be referencing a much better movie, but in the original Ghostbusters film, they implied that the mad architect that built the apartment building, Ivo Shandor was his name, you know, used weird metallurgy and used weird composites and weird shit to build the building, and that's why it's a portal into the dimension of Gozer the Gozerian. I thought that they were going to imply, like I said, as an architect, he was given really weird requests, which he followed through, and all of a sudden he realizes, oh my goodness, I'm building actually blah 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 blah, which is going to turn into a portal to Kunlun, but I didn't finish this one part here, and they need this one part here, or something like that.
Thing is, if they're using feng shui, the stupid thing would be like, I'm pointing your bonsai north. You're defeated now.
Yeah.
You're technically correct, but you get my point that they were implying something that just wasn't there. Like, he shot himself in the head because he's like, you're not going to get what's in my head. And it's like, what was it? And why was he so important as an architect? I mean, he looked down at the bottom of the hole and he saw a dome and he's like, oh, okay. Oh my god, no, it's a dome! Oh my god, I gotta get some bombs!
An alien ship, fuck!
But yeah. Again, we get like a sense that he stared into the face of God himself and became a righteous man because of it. And at the end it turns out, no, it's just plot convenience that he did this. And that's like a letdown. Let's talk about how the series ended. So obviously the building comes down, everyone's happy. Matt Murdock is lost in action, but we see a scene where he is being tended to by a nun, and the nun says, "Get
this." He wakes up in Norm Taggart's fucking lab.
Well, he wakes up and he says, "Get Sister Maggie." Sister Maggie, of course, is Matt Murdock's mother. abusive mother who beat him as he was a baby.
Yeah.
Because he had postpartum depression.
Makes sense to me. No, it's I love that the clearly season 3 of Daredevil is going to be a televised version of Born Again. You know, it's we've talked about Daredevil on the show before. There's that scene from the end of Born Again arc where he's walking down the street with Karen Page, and he's like, "I'm Matt Murdock," and he gives his origin. And it's just like one of the quintessential Daredevil scenes in my mind. That's how I want to see that season end, about him, you know, taking his life back and going like that. I don't mind that at all, that they're doing that as a Born Again. Because after everything, like, he's at a pretty low point in the series. I mean, he destroyed his legal career in season 2 of Daredevil during the Punisher parts. You know, he's basically sacrificed his life because, you know, stubborn as hell, but he's never going to give up on the woman he loves, and we see how well that turned out for him. And but yeah, the end of the series, like, Daredevil's thought to be dead. Presumably Madame Gao is dead, although if they kill her off, I'm going to be very disappointed. You know, Daredevil's alive. He's in a convent somewhere in New York City. Danny is basically taking up the mantle of the defender of New York City, as, you know, he's going to be. I love how you see that last shot. He's not in the green and yellow union suit with the mask, but it's close enough because he's essentially wearing the current kind of a version of his current costume, which is like the very Game of Death in style inspired tracksuit. You know, Luke and Claire are presumably still a couple, and he's going to reopen Pop's barbershop and being the hero of Harlem. You know, Jessica is kind of accepted the fact that she's a quote-unquote hero and reopened properly Alias Investigations. You know, so going forward, we'll see what happens in the next installment of Defenders, if that's how they end Phase 2.
All right.
One thing I'm going to ask before we sew it up, Ben. I'm going to go with you and then Red. My favorite moment of the series, bar none, was the ending of Episode 4. In that last shot after Jessica boot fucks the car through the window, runs over some hand, walks in, they all line up and, you know, raise their fists like, let's do this. That's my favorite moment of the series. Well, I'm going to ask you, Ben, and then you, Red, what are your favorite moments? One favorite moment of the series.
Them eating Chinese food and having a conversation.
Takes a lot of energy or a lot of food to fuel my chi, that moment.
Just the whole overall conversation. The fact that, like I said, I think that speaks about who is writing certain dialogue scenes versus who is writing, who is choreographing action scenes, that I found they sit and talk more interesting than they fight. So, okay. Red.
What about, what's your favorite, Red?
My favorite part is when Punisher shows up. Oh, wait, they hinted that in the trailer, but it never fucking happened.
Fuck you.
Yeah, and the most Punisher we get is that I found it. They say it's such an awesome trailer, as I found it very confusing of when Frank showed up in that teaser trailer at the end.
Like, what they should have done is Matt should have made a phone call, and when shit's going down, all of a sudden Frank shows up and starts fucking just mowing through the hand.
Welcome back, Frank. But overall, I would rate Defenders as if you have like a Saturday and you're like doing a lot of chores and you want just something on to like watch occasionally, like maybe put the Defenders on Netflix. I wouldn't say it's like a good, it's like event watching or anything like that, or even really great for binge watching. It was okay at best. JT?
On a scale of 1 to 5, I'm going to give it 3 Excelsiors out of 5. It's a solid miniseries. It's doesn't tie every loose thread up from the preceding Netflix series, but I find it a hell of a lot better than Iron Fist. Not quite. I put it a little bit more comic book entertaining than the other series, but definitely, you know, 3 out of 5. It's a solid watch. You don't necessarily have to marathon it all at once. I'd say do 4 and then another 4 episodes. How about you, Red?
On a scale of original Star Trek The Voyager, I would say it's a Deep Space Nine.
Nice. I like that.
Ouch. I mean, honestly, I think Deep Space Nine is better than Voyager by a lot, but...
Oh, I said Deep Space. I said Voyager. That's the middle. There's so, still Enterprise, and there's still...
Next
the
gen.
Fucking movie, the 2009 movies
okay.
that are under Deep Space Nine.
Voyager being a one, and original series being the five.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, let's wrap this up. This is your host, Ben.
JT from Saskatoon.
Ready?
We're saying goodnight.
So long.
Peace out.
Alright, so...
We got an episode. I'm going to do some posts on it either tonight or tomorrow morning, and we'll get it up.
Okay. On so, like I said, like Mondays, obviously, I'm doing the karate thing. Tuesday, we are going to do it this time, boys. We're going to do Magus versus Zilla.
Alright. See you then. Good night.
Okay. And me, I'm going to lose about 3 hours of my life to playing Overwatch, because I bought that yesterday.
Okay. Fine.